听力课堂，听 class.com。
Step by step 2000, book 4.
Unit 7, Love and Help, 1. Part 1, Warming Up. A. Listen to a very brief report about problems for U.S. school children. According to the report,What are the top 7 problems for the U.S. school children in the 1940s? And what are the 7 problems that youngsters in the U.S. schools face today? Listen carefully and note down the problems.
In the 1940s, the top 7 problems for U.S. school children were number 1, talking in class. Number 2, chewing gum. Number 3, making noise. Number 4, running in the halls.Number 5, cutting in line. Number 6, dress code violations. Number 7, littering. Today's youngsters in U.S. schools face a set of 7 problems that are much more shocking. Number 1, drug abuse. Number 2, alcohol abuse. Number 3, teen pregnancy. Number 4, suicide. Number 5, rape. Number 6, robbery.Number 7, assault.
B. You're going to hear a short report on crime and violence in the United States. Listen carefully and complete the following outline.
Looking into crime and violence in the United States is like opening the proverbial can of worms. So many different problems emerge from the can that you sometimes feel the more you know,the less you understand. What is very clear and indisputable, however, is that violent crime has increased greatly in the United States in recent decades. By violent crime, I mean crimes like robbery, assault, murder, and rape. The murder rate is twice as high as 30 years ago, and violent crime in general has increased 23% in the same time period. What is also clear is that the general public is afraid of becoming victims of violent crime. Statistics are harder to come by for white-collar crime. Crimes including embezzlement, bribery, political corruption, and corporate policies that endanger workers and the public.But many experts agree that there has been an increase in white-collar crime, too. As for solutions, I think most of us would agree that the family can play a role in reducing crime in the United States. Through socialization, which leads children to respect themselves, others, and the values of their society. Moreover, I think society...in the form of government, has a role to play in reducing crime by helping people to feel that they are part of the society instead of its victims. The government, in the form of the justice system, can also contribute to curbing crime by instilling the fear of punishment in those who might become criminals.
See.Now listen to a short report about child malnutrition. Listen carefully. Complete the following statements with the information you hear on the tape.
A new food policy study predicts slowing progress against child malnutrition over the next 20 years unless governments take more aggressive action.The International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington says international efforts to reduce the number of malnourished children in the world have been woefully inadequate.
It predicts that despite a 20% decline in the number of malnourished children by 2020, 132 million will still be underfed. The cost of cutting child malnutrition in half by 2020 would be an extra $10 billion a year. $25 billion are now invested in developing countries annually to boost farm productivity, secure clean water sources, develop rural infrastructure, and improve education and health. $10 billion more is a scant amount. Not all regions face equally bleak food futures. Latin America will virtually eliminate child malnutrition by 2020, and China will cut it in half. But the Food Policy Organization says India will continue to have one-third of the world's underfed children, and Africa will see an 18% increase unless action is taken.
D. Read the following difficult sentences and listen.
But when kids commit crimes, whether it's dealing drugs, weapons possession, or gangbanging, only 13 states hold parents criminally liable. Family law experts say that what's most needed now is a thorough review of the effectiveness of such laws before more are put in place, because thus far, they simply don't seem to be deterring school shootings, let alone bad parenting.
The things that we usually use to teach our children how to stay safe in shopping malls and on streets and in life don't ordinarily apply online, because parents just don't understand it well enough to set the rules. So the pedophiles are using this technology and the fact that they can hide behind anonymity and pretend they're another child to lure our children in ways that we're not yet prepared to teach our children to avoid. We are also committed to helping schools and teachers and libraries get the most out of the Internet by learning how to use it and developing safety programs and education programs for parents, so that parents will let their children be on the Internet and help them deal with the risks they'll face day to day from predators and from kooks and crackpots and misinformation and hate that they will face, so that we're here to empower the parents to help keep the children safe.
Part 2.
Love and Help. A. In this section, you are going to hear a report about compulsive gamblers. Listen carefully. Note down the answers to the following two questions.
Compulsive gamblers almost always come from homes lacking in love. As a result, the child grows up still looking for the warmth of family love and parental approval. Another aspect of the nature of the gambling addict is that unconsciously he wants to lose. Psychiatrists believe that compulsive gamblers consciously may expect to win. However, there is a strong element of self-destruction in their inclination to continue betting until all is lost. One New York psychiatrist believes that basically the compulsive gambler is seeking an answer to the question, "Do you love me?" By winning, he receives a yes answer. However, the gambler cannot accept the yes he sometimes receives because it is contrary to the reality of his or her unhappy childhood, one lacking in family love. The gambler is compelled to continue betting, thus expressing again and again his need for love and acceptance. When gambling addicts do win some money, they rarely spend any of it.
Come. It's evening?
Yep.
And our guests are coming soon.
I hope you're hungry.
It reminds me of growing up in Texas. In Texas, they're very famous for barbecue. They are very serious about barbecue. And one thing that's interesting about grilling and barbecue is that it's one form of cooking that men like to do. In the West, in the U.S. in particular, a lot of men don't cook at all. But all in the summer, they'll go out and cook on the grill. They'll light the charcoal with fire, and they'll put the meat out there just like they were cavemen. And, of course, the women are usually setting the table and making the salads and helping a lot, but the men like to say...
...at GA with saving them from their addiction and helping them to build new lives free from the gambling sickness. Happily, today, with more public interest in helping the gambling addict overcome his problem, and with such organizations as the GA... The gambler who wants help to break his addiction now has some place or someone to turn to.
B. You're going to hear a report about whether or not parents should be held criminally liable when their kids commit crimes. Listen carefully. Complete the following summary.
In just about every state, parents are held responsible for certain misdeeds of their children, especially if it's school-related, like destroying school property or missing school. But when kids commit crimes, whether it's dealing drugs, weapons possession, or gangbanging, only 13 states hold parents criminally liable. Now, in the wake of the Colorado shootings, more lawmakers are saying parents should be jailed or fined when their kids commit a crime. And there seems to be a certain logic to this trend. The most important influence on the development of a child is the parent. What people really want is good parenting. The question is, can state legislatures legislate good parenting?
How do you legislate good parenting, and how far should we go with that?
There should be a law that does punish parents for leaving a loaded gun around accessible for children.
That's something you can hold me accountable for. But when you tell me I should raise a child in a way that that child will not have bad thoughts or be depressed or not hang around with the wrong kids, you're trying to legislate something that, you know, parenting is not an easy thing. This is a hard job.
And it gets harder as kids get older. Studies show that when a child becomes a teenager, parents' involvement with their children and their education drops sharply. This complicates matters for the courts if they're out to prove that a parent should have known about the child's intentions to commit a crime or stop the child from doing it. By 15 to 16 years of age, children in this country are treated as quasi-adults.
We also have young people at that age leading very separate lives that parents are not fully informed of. Many of those young people are working. They have a strong peer group affiliation. Perhaps we might have some idealistic view that a law would then force parents to hold daily sessions with their children, asking them what they're doing. I just don't think that's going to work.
Parent liability law.
Serving our country to give all our young people a chance to have a better life. This is the way we have to meet our challenges. Business working together with government and labor, religious and community groups join forces, people lending a hand to help one another. Today, we take another important step to build on that progress. The spirit of the Service Summit is stronger than ever, and it's up to us, all of us, to keep it alive as we move forward together into a new century. Thanks for listening.
B. Now listen to the speech again and answer the following questions. This time, pay more attention to the important supporting details.
Innocence and Danger. Here is an interview on internet safety, especially for children. Listen carefully. Complete the summary.
Internet communication can be dangerous for adults, and children are even more vulnerable. Homera Sellier and Perry Aftab work with an organization called Innocence in Danger. It's a world citizens movement to protect children from sexual abuse and pedophilia on the internet. Perry, it would seem that in the United States there would be lots of laws protecting children against abuse on the internet.
Well, there are laws to protect children from abuse online and offline. They apply equally in both places. The problem is that children use the internet and far more often know more about it than their parents do. So the things that we usually use to teach our children how to stay safe in shopping malls and on streets and in life don't ordinarily apply online because parents just don't understand it well enough to set the rules. So the pedophiles are using this technology and the fact that they can hide behind anonymity and pretend they're another child to lure our children in ways that we're not yet prepared to teach our children to avoid.
One of the goals of UNESCO is to make sure all children have access to the internet. And yet in doing this, you want to make sure they have access safely. It sounds like a huge task to get companies and countries involved in doing this.
It is a huge task. I do agree with you. It is a worldwide problem, and that is the reason why our action has to be global and international. I think even though it's a very big task, we are little by little going to get there with everybody's help.
What are some of the other dangers? I mean, we've talked a little bit or alluded to child pornography. How does that impact children?
Often the pedophiles use child pornography to desensitize our children. So if they're setting a conversation up and they send a photo to a 10-year-old of another 10-year-old engaged in sexual activity, that 10-year-old now thinks that perhaps it's not so unusual and it's not so contraband for them to engage in sexual activity as well. And that's typically how it's used.
And is there one other aspect regarding hate email or hate websites?
Well, I think the biggest danger, obviously, is not from information, but from people who want to hurt children. But there are hate sites and bigotry and intolerance. There are sites where children can order guns and poison and drugs and tobacco and alcohol. There are sites that teach our children how to build bombs, and unfortunately, they are building bombs with this information. And there's a lot of misinformation and cults. And that is quite dangerous. And in addition, our children may be exposed to information that parents would prefer they're not exposed to. Because of this, what we need to do is arm parents with the tools they need to educate their children and keep them safe and make sure that law enforcement does what they can to clean up the criminal activities online.
What are your specific tasks in the United States?
Three prongs are making sure that children are safe from predators, that we try to do what we can to control child pornography. We work closely with law enforcement. We get all of the internet service providers and all of the internet industry on board. And I should tell you that most of them are there already as part of committed members of the National Action Committee. We are also committed to helping schools and teachers and libraries get the most out of the internet by learning how to use it and developing safety programs and education programs for parents so that parents will let their children be on the internet and help them deal with the risks they'll face day to day from predators and from kooks and crackpots and misinformation and hate that they will face, so that we're here to empower the parents to help keep the children safe.
Part 4. Listen and relax. You're going to hear a radio program called Lifesaver. Listen and enjoy.
Ken Schuler, a husband, a father, an artist. He also saved another person's life in the most remarkable way. Schuler is the first known person to step forward and donate part of his liver to a stranger. It happened like this. He heard this man plead for his daughter's life.
I'm hoping that there'd be somebody out there that would be kind enough to help my daughter.
39-year-old Debbie Parker's liver had been destroyed by hepatitis C. The wife and mother of three needed a liver transplant. Without one, she would die within days. Because the list for a liver from a cadaver was so long, doctors suggested a new experimental option, a living donor liver transplant. That is, a living person could give Debbie a piece of his or her liver.
They said they were looking for a B-positive donor, which that's what I am. And as soon as I heard that, I looked at my wife and said I would do that in a heartbeat. Got up and made the phone call. We met in the waiting room, and we were both having blood work done. And that was probably one of the best days of my life.
I tapped him on the shoulder and I said, "Are you Ken Schuler?" And he goes, "Yes, I am." I said, "I'm Debbie Parker." And we just embraced right there, and the whole waiting room started crying.
I was trying to save somebody's life, and she was, you know, wanting me to save her life. And when somebody hugs you around the neck like that, it still gets to me thinking about it.
But even at that point, they couldn't be sure if Ken would qualify as a donor. Earlier, Debbie's brother had come forward to be a donor, but he did not qualify medically.
It is a highly risky. It's a risky operation.
Dr. Amadeo Marcos did the first unrelated living donor liver transplant a year ago and has done 27 since then. Most have been between husbands and wives.
We were forced to do this technique because we ourselves did not have enough livers for our own list, and our patients were dying.
There are only a handful of centers in the United States offering living donor liver transplants in adults. If more widely used, doctors say it's an option that can make a significant dent in the organ shortage. But ethically, can you ask someone to undertake the risk of donating part of their liver?
I think you can. I don't think it's unethical to have a wife volunteer to have a piece of her liver given to her child or to her husband. It's probably not even unethical to do it for friends.
But you are operating on a healthy person who doesn't have anything wrong with them, and I think we should always remember that.
Ken Schuler says he was not concerned about the possible risk of dying or becoming disabled. One week after Ken...
Capri Land and Busch Gardens, from Japanese health spas to exclusive shops in California's Beverly Hills. Ken Calkins, his musicians, never talk back to him.
Two. Listen again. Complete the following statements.